Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you are doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me, as always, is a man that likes to rock and roll all night and part of every day. He is the captain.
Well, Beth, what can I do? It's good to be seen, and it's good to see you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling your friend.
Tonight, the fridge is full with Genesee beer, garage grade 3 out of 5 bottle caps.
Genesee
beer is an American icon, Captain, and today every can, every bottle, every pint glass delivers the same full taste and quality that made it famous way back in 1878 when you were in high school.
That was my jam.
Genesee is truly a great classic beer, and this week's fridge is full thanks to these truly great guys and girls. First up, we have, in the greatest town in America, parts unknown, we have Alex. We also have Lori. And we also have Leanne. And just a quick announcement to the great people of Parts Unknown. The annual early spring tractor pull has been postponed until it stops snowing. Look for announcements soon, hopefully.
And a big shout out to Ashley in Greensburg, Pennsylvania.
Let's go north of the border. Let's say thank you to LaDonna up in Fort McMurray, Canada. Also in Canada, a shout out to Karina in Ottawa. Wait, want to do one more Canada shout out. A long distance cheers to Tarina in Port Coquitlam, British Columbia.
There is no way that you got that correct. It's about time that you start looking this stuff up.
Let's give a cheers to Tiffany in Bellman, Iowa. And last but not least, we have Amy from Kirkland, Washington.
Cheers,
everybody. Thanks to everybody for filling up the fridge for this week's show. If you want to help us out with next week's show, go to truecrimegarage.com. Click on the donate button.
And we have some special announcements coming up soon. Some things to tell you. But if you're not listening on the Stitcher app, you want to go download that Stitcher app for free today. And that's enough of the business.
Everybody gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer. Let's talk some true crime. Following is taken from letters to John Paul Fay from Arthur Shawcross, written behind prison walls. Hello, John. You can call me Art if you want. The stationery you chose is quite good. Reminds me of someone I knew one time. Tied up, blindfolded, and gagged is good. Her legs would not be tied. Wide open. I like blondes, brunettes, redheads, or whatever. But I am choosy in the type I crave. But at times I lose control and it's as if I made a snuff film. You forgot to mention a saw or two. My specialty is the keyhole saw. It's what I used on 3 victims. Then you have the jigsaw. Real handy. OJ didn't kill Nicole. His friend did. Think about it. He also had a white Bronco. It's very strange it was gotten rid of right away. So you tell me. Something worth looking into? John, if you want a woman for the winter, pull one of the homeless. She will like it inside all winter. Then in the spring, let her go. I've been there. All winter with 2 women in the apartment. What tastes better than pork? Jeffrey Dahmer was into eating and torturing his homosexual partners. As for me, I only ate certain parts. Quite tasty at that. Don't need salt either. Ed Gein's last victim was just about like one of mine, but not tied up. Mine was laying back, legs open, with a silly grin on her mug. John, the Saw Man. Every human, no matter what color, looks the same after they're skinned. If you go to Southern Cal, stay away from any earthquake section. AIDS lets you and I waste some morons. Be cool, pal. Don't hurt anyone. At least don't get caught at it. Gotta go, pal. Good day. Art. Anna Marie Steffen, age 27, was an emaciated sex worker who took to working the streets to support a drug habit. She was last seen alive on Saturday, July 8, 1989, while walking along Lyle Avenue. Arthur Shawcross had met her by the Princess Restaurant on Lake Avenue, and he walked with her to the back of the YMCA. He then drove her down to the driving park, and during oral sex, he grabbed her throat and strangled her before rolling her body over the edge of the Genesee River Gorge. It is reported that she was frustrated after Arthur could not get an erection after 40 minutes. It's also alleged that she threatened to tell the police that she had seen Arthur Shawcross with Dotsie. Remember, she was the victim that we discussed yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Anna Marie's body was found on Sunday, September 11th, 1988. This is by Hector Maldonado, while he was searching for returnable bottles so that he could save up some money to buy cigarettes. The victim was lying on her left side, curled in a semi-fetal position. A pair of Calvin Klein jeans were pulled down around the ankles and turned inside out. A white tank top with red shoulder straps was wrapped around the right wrist, and a clump of hair had been ripped from the skull. The eyes were missing from their sockets. Now, just 3 weeks later, on Saturday, July 29th, 1989, Dorothy Keller, this was supposedly Shawcross's friend, would be his third victim. Now, she was different from the first two in the sense that she was not a sex worker. She was a 58-year-old woman. She was homeless. And Shawcross had met Dorothy when she worked as a waitress in a diner that he had gone to. The two struck up a friendship, which had quickly turned into an affair. On an afternoon, this was on his way to fish in the river.
Mm-hmm.
He stopped when he saw Keller to speak with her. When she found out where he was going, she asked if he could take her with him, and he agreed. According to Shawcross, they spent the morning fishing and making love until around midday when it started to rain.
Now, didn't she live with him at some point?
I believe so. There were a couple people that Shawcross had affairs with, or so he would later claim, because right. We have this individual here that would end up a murder victim. That can't tell us otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I think that we're going to see here with Shawcross is there seems to be a reason for most of these murders, or at least a reason that he has made up in his mind. You know, either the woman made fun of him or bit him or assaulted him or mm-hmm. tried to rob him, and therefore he lost control and decided to kill them.
And with Dorothy, the interview that I saw, Arthur was saying that Dorothy lived with him and that he also paid her some weird amount, like $4.32 or something, to clean the apartment.
Yeah, he would claim that there was a couple things that sent him into a rage. You know, they're huddling together in this crude shelter that Shawcross put together mm-hmm. while it rains out there. And he states that while they're huddling together, they get into some kind of argument. And it starts off with an argument about her stealing money. And then it turns into they're arguing about his relationships that he has with Rose and with Clara. He claimed that she started to threaten him, saying that she was going to tell the other women about their affair.
Right.
And this is when Arthur Shawcross became angry. He picked up a small log and he beat her on the side of the head until he killed her. Now, he hid her body under a fallen tree, and then he went home. Her body was found on October 21st, but he later told police that at one time he had returned to the spot several months later and removed the skull and dumped it in the river.
Yeah, and in the interview I saw, they said, "Oh, how did you, remove the skull?" He said, "You just do."
You just do.
Yeah, he doesn't have that big of an accent, but
yeah,
sounded better. Sounded better in my head.
On Friday, September 29th, 1989, Patricia Ives, this was another Lake Avenue sex worker, also known as Crazy Patty. She was 25 years old at the time, drug dependent, a high school dropout. She did have a baby, a young child, who had been placed in foster care. Some say that she once was a very attractive woman, that she used to bear more of a resemblance to the film star Julia Roberts. But by this point, because the drugs had taken their toll and she was
right,
a bit of a walking skeleton. She had ragged and unkept hair. And she also had needle marks from her elbows to her fingers.
Yeah, that's sad.
It was also believed that she might have had the AIDS virus. Now, Arthur Shawcross claims that she offered him sex for $25 when he approached the same diner where Dorothy Keller had worked. He agreed to this, and they went to a construction site. While there and while having sex, Shawcross says that he caught Ives trying to remove his wallet and pushed her hard against the ground. She began to cry, and he raped her and began to strangle her until she didn't move anymore. Shawcross said that there were children playing nearby, and he states that, "I put my hand over her mouth and held her nose. She didn't struggle. She didn't holler. She didn't fight." That he knew her, and that Patty had been in the company of a white male who was riding a bike with balloon tires. There were fishing rods protruding from the cycle's rear baskets. Patty was reported missing the following day by her pimp slash boyfriend, who on the streets went by the name, get ready for this guy.
Okay.
This
is the pimp's name.
Yes.
Okay.
Rat Face Billy. You can't make this stuff up, I'm telling you.
Who's your boyfriend? Oh, old rat face.
We shouldn't laugh. Patty's body was found by children who were looking for a lost baseball on Friday, October 27th, when they saw a foot sticking out from a pile of flattened cardboard. The corpse was clothed in black pants and a sweatshirt lying face up, and a wedding ring was missing from her finger. There were no shoes or socks on the body, and maggots had devoured most of the flesh. On October 23rd, 1989, June Stott was 30 years old, was the youngest of eight children. She was homeless. She apparently heard mysterious voices in her head and had been taken to sleeping on Lyle Avenue. Now, she's different in a sense that she's not a sex worker or a drug addict. This is something that you and I have spoke about before on our little show here, our little garage show, that taking care of people that have mental health issues.
Yeah, but I mean, I also think we have issues with, trying to take care of, the sex workers. I mean, whether it's, should be legal or shouldn't be legal, I mean, we have to do a better job.
Well, I only point that out here because from everything I could gather, it appears that this young woman was simply homeless because of the problems she had, and it wasn't due to drugs or anything right of that nature, that she simply needed to be taken care of and didn't have anyone to help her with this.
Yeah.
Now, Shawcross, this is what we will see time and time again from monsters like Shawcross. They will find somebody. They will come across somebody with, let's say, what he would determine to be a weakness. And he's going to prey upon that person and make them further victimize them because he can.
Yeah, he's going to talk her into going fishing with him, which we know is a bad thing.
Well, and when they're down by the water, he's trying to talk her into having sex with him. Right. And she refuses, and he says this is when he decided to strangle her.
Yeah.
Now, 2 days later, he returned to the body and he dragged it down into the, there's an area there with those large cat tails. He dragged the body there and using a knife, he cut open her body from the breastbone to the crotch.
Yeah.
He then gutted her like a fish, using his words, throwing the entrails into the river. On Thursday, November...
Well, hold on. I just want to point out that in the interview I watched on him, he claims that this attack happened and he didn't leave. He was there all day and that he actually cut her open beforehand.
Before returning to the body.
Right. Now, that's what he claims. Now, the only reason why I bring that up is that you see a lot of times in his stories. Now, he's either misremembering or he's making stuff up as
Correct.
He goes along.
Correct. Yeah. And on Thursday, November 23rd, a man walking his dog, he noticed an ice-covered object. It was a piece of carpet under which was the badly decomposed body of June Stott.
Mm-hmm.
The corpse was face down, but lividity staining showed that she had been rolled over long after death. The right leg was bent inward at the knee, elevating the buttocks and suggesting the possibility of intercourse after death with the body. The vagina was missing from the body, and Arthur Shawcross later said that he had ate it.
Yeah, and wow, this is a graphic show. But law enforcement are now well aware that they're looking for a serial killer.
Well, and that's kind of a unique situation, I guess, in the sense that that's not always the case. You know, sometimes they arrest a guy for a murder and then later find out that he's guilty of three or four or five.
Right.
Here we have enough of a consistency in victims and how often they are finding these victims that they're well aware that they're probably looking for, they're at least looking for a serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
It's undetermined if all of these are connected to the same guy or not.
Yeah, so they actually had a couple sting operations that they set up and having police officers go undercover. And because, you know, a lot of these victims were sex workers, so they were trying to, you know, figure this out. Now, what Arthur talks about in his interview is that he used to hang out at Dunkin' Donuts,
mm-hmm.
and he happened to be wearing, like, for whatever reason, he says, some very shiny shoes. And so when these officers were in there talking about this stuff, that they kind of just assumed because of his shiny shoes that he was law enforcement.
Okay.
But none of them were dressed in uniform. So they started talking about how they're trying to run the sting operation.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, by just being at that donut shop, he learned... I know there's probably a bunch of cop jokes out there with the donut shop, but he learned all the decoys, and so he could stay away from them.
Right, right. He would overhear these officers talking about their investigation. At times, he was even speaking with them. And he was a regular in several diners and coffee shops, and this allowed him access to those individuals. Now, there were several victims in the course of November of 1989,
mm-hmm.
Marie Welch, Francis Brown. There's one that I do want to talk about in particular. This is a story from early November 1989. A woman by the name of Joanne Van Nostrand told police about a client named Mitch, a guy that called himself Mitch, who had paid her to play dead. The man also tried to strangle her.
Mm.
She pulled a knife on him and fought him off. This was the first real lead the investigators received. It was the second time that the man with the same physical description named either Mike or Mitch had been mentioned in reference to the murders. Interviews with many of the Lyle Street sex workers indicated that he was a regular and that he had the reputation of being violent with the women.
And Elizabeth Gibson was also one of his victims.
Yes, she was last seen working the streets on Lyle Avenue on Saturday, November 25th. Her body was found just 2 days later by a deer hunter walking through the woods. Now, at this crime scene, police discovered tire impressions in the muddy ground, and they also discovered blue paint chips from where a vehicle had scraped a tree. Now, this paint would later be matched to Claire's blue Dodge Omni. This was, of course, a vehicle that Shawcross often borrowed. His ninth victim, or believed to be ninth victim, was Darlene Trippi, age 32. She was last seen alive by her sister on Friday, December 15th. It wasn't until after his arrest that Shawcross was able to direct police to Darlene's frozen body. I want to point out something, though, here, Captain. We're seeing a frequency to this, aren't we? I mean, we're talking about multiple victims in the same month. Mm-hmm. We're talking about what they would later say, probably 11 victims is what we're looking at, is pretty much a certainty. Probably more victims were involved in this series that were not included in his later convictions.
Possibly, yeah.
But we're seeing what we've seen from time to time before. You know, when we discussed Ted Bundy or the Green River Killer, where you see a guy that has this capability, that has murder on his mind, who is appears to almost have spiraled out of control to the point where he's murdering two, three people a month.
Well, let's talk about how old Noodle Dick is caught.
Well, so the investigation kind of works like this. Mm-hmm. We have most of the victims were sex workers who worked in the red light district of Lake and Lyle Avenues. The women were either strangled or beaten to death, and each was disposed of naked or partially clothed around the city and close to or in water. Most of the victims had debris stuffed into their ears, nose, and other body cavities. Mm-hmm. Their clothes were often found neatly folded or close to the corpses, which ranged in decomposition from skeletal to preserved. In several instances, the body exhibited signs of having been partially eaten by wild animals or cannibalized by the killer himself. Recognizing these patterns, the Rochester police doubled the size of its physical crimes unit. Round-the-clock surveillance by Rochester PD Tactical Unit focused attention on the red light district, where many of the victims were last seen to be alive. The services of the FBI profilers were called upon to complete a psychological profile of the serial killer. The successful capture of Arthur J. Shawcross was due to an equal combination of good luck and dogged police work. Ultimately, though, it was the mindset of this psychopath that ultimately sealed his fate. One of Shawcross's last victims was June Cicero. She was aged 34. She was a strong character with a drug habit. She had arrived in Rochester from Brooklyn, New York in 1973, and she had been well known on the streets of Rochester, where she was regarded as something of a mother figure to many of the younger women who operated in the red light district.
She was a pistol.
Yes. June suddenly disappeared without a trace from the red light district. This was on the late evening of Sunday, December 17th, 1989. Now, where this comes into play here, Captain, is a police helicopter crew spotted her frozen corpse lying in the icy Salmon Creek on Wednesday, January 3rd, 1990. Mm-hmm. The body was naked except for a white sweater and white socks. Arthur Shawcross was seen standing on a nearby bridge by the same helicopter, and he was seen dropping something into the creek before driving off in the vehicle. It was this incident that would later lead to his arrest.
Well, this is kind of confusing. So the body was found on the 3rd. And what we think, based off of reports, is on the 4th is when they would see him. Because what law enforcement started to understand is whoever is committing these murders is going back to the scene. So he probably dumped her body before the 3rd. She was found on the 3rd. Probably the 4th is when he is caught, which in my reports he's urinating on the bridge. Some have speculated that he was masturbating on the bridge.
Well, and I think in regards to that, Captain, they couldn't determine what it was he was doing. I think they could determine that possibly his pants were down or his fly was unzipped.
Yeah. And then so I think they ended up pulling him over.
Well, what they ultimately end up doing is the vehicle that he is in that night, they're able to trace that vehicle. Mm-hmm. And they trace that vehicle back to him in a sense that they connect it to him because it belongs to one of the women that he's seeing. Remember, he's right. Taking turns driving his wife's car and his girlfriend's car from time to time to pick up these women to commit these murders. Well, when they trace this vehicle back to him, it doesn't take long for them to run his background and figure out that this dude has murdered people in the past. He's been convicted of one murder.
Right.
And what they decide to do is they decide to, okay, he claims that he had no involvement in any of this. However, they're going to give him the night to rest, but they're going to observe him. They're going to surveil him. They're going to keep him under their watchful eye. Early that next morning is when they take him down to the police headquarters. One thing that the detectives that spoke to Arthur Shawcross in his questioning or interrogation, whatever you want to call it, This was not FBI agents. These were local detectives. And they kind of picked up on some personality traits of Arthur Shawcross very quickly into speaking with him. One, they found that he was a talker, that he liked to talk, that he liked to open up. If you kept him comfortable, he would keep speaking to you.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, he seemed to want to...
Never trust a talker.
He seemed to want to be their friends in some kind of weird way. Even though he was denying all their claims, he seemed to be wanting to be their friends in the sense that he wanted to open up to them.
Mm-hmm.
They used a tactic that I found pretty interesting, which is a little bit weird because this guy has got no soul, my friend. This guy has got no conscience. This guy does not care about human beings or life in general.
I mean, he even said in his interview, I have no remorse.
Yes. And what they do is they start saying, look, we don't want it. You need to fess up to these murders because we don't want anybody else to get in trouble for this. Mm-hmm. And what they meant was, okay, you're using your wife's car to commit these murders. You're using your girlfriend's car to commit these murders. Those two, one of those two or both had to know what you were up to. One of those two or both maybe were helping you commit these murders.
Yeah, and he simply just said, after hours and hours of them questioning him and things coming at him is what he said.
Yeah.
As he just got tired of it, so he just confessed.
Yeah, and so he confesses to the murders. Not all of the series that they had at the time. I believe it was 14 or 15 murders in total that they had questioned him about. He would later confess to many of them, actually leading them to a couple of the bodies that had been undiscovered at that time. But it was just in December of 1990 when Arthur Shawcross was convicted of killing 10 women after jurors decided he was sane and deliberated for only 6.5 hours. The judge sentenced him to 25 years for each count, a total of 250 years imprisonment. A few months later, Shawcross was taken to Wayne County and tried for Elizabeth Gibson's murder. Rather than claim insanity this time, he pled guilty and received a further life sentence.
All right. Cheers, me mateys.
Cheers, Captain. Now, prison officials said that Arthur Shawcross complained of a pain in his leg on the afternoon of November 10th, 2008. He was taken to Albany Medical Center, where he went into cardiac arrest. Arthur Shawcross died that evening at 9:50 p.m. He was cremated, and later his ashes were given to his daughter. Now, before his death, there was a relationship that Arthur Shawcross developed, a pen pal relationship with a man named John Paul Fay. And earlier this year, a book came out called The Shawcross Letters, which gives an inside look at Arthur Shawcross, one of America's most notorious serial killers. The Shawcross Letters is a graphic and dramatic true crime book that will horrify, enlighten, and keep you up at night. Author Brian Whitney teamed up with John Paul Fay to write this book to show us what happens when one of the most evil men in the history of America meets a man he trusts enough to share his darkest secrets with. And on the phone with us here in the garage is John Paul Fay, the man that was pen pals with convicted serial killer Arthur Shawcross.
Now, John, this is kind of interesting because Arthur actually reached out to you. You didn't actually reach out to him.
Well, first of all, he reached out to me first. And initially, I was selling some of his artwork on eBay back when he could sell the murderabilia. And I ended up with his artwork through interesting trades I did with, say, fans of his, quote-unquote, groupies. And I used to sell various videotapes and that type of thing, like uncut horror movies. And so when I got those drawings, I decided to resell them. And Arthur discovered this. And he ended up getting my address from one of his fans, believe it or not, with whom I've traded. And one day I went to the mailbox, and there was a letter from the Sullivan Correctional Facility, Arthur Shawcross. And of course, at first I was a bit taken aback. I went to a quiet spot to read the letter away from so-called family members. And he had mentioned that he knew I was selling some of his artwork and all this stuff. And I wasn't sure how to take it initially. You know, if I should feel threatened. But so I just collected myself. And I wrote him back a letter. It was, a very gentlemanly letter. There was no problems. And I just said, if you could do more drawings, basically, you know, we could split the proceeds and go from there. And so he got back to me and said, sure, basically, that's a great idea. Let's go ahead with that. And so he started doing artwork for me, which I'd resell and split that with him. I just sent him a money order. So then we just we developed a friendship from there, and it became very close for her. I hate to say it. I saw him as a kind of father figure just because my own life has been so twisted as far as male role models, quote unquote. And it got strange. Obviously, it's deep down the rabbit hole, that type of thing. But that's where I live anyway. You know, I've always been a very kind of twisted, dark character myself, with say similar thoughts to a Jeffrey Dahmer, kind of Jeffrey Dahmer 2.0. Dahmer, if you were a writer, I think. But of course, I've come very close to engaging in those activities myself. But I mean, I think that's the summary answer.
All right, so you did hear that correctly. You're probably listening and going, "What? I'm more the Jeffrey Dahmer type. What is John talking about?" Well, so he gets some items from Arthur, and he's selling them on eBay, and then Arthur reaches out to him, and he says, "Hey, if you draw some more drawings, I can sell these." Mm-hmm. And as they're communicating back and forth, John opens up to Arthur and says, "Hey, man, I got some dark thoughts that I have."
Yeah, it sounds like John, you know, has a troubled past, mm-hmm. a possibly troubled childhood that we can ask more questions about, but this leading to alcoholism, some drug use, and some very dark fantasies, mm-hmm. to which he's going to confide his thoughts and feelings with this monster, Arthur Shawcross, who's reached out to him. So, John, you say that a friendship developed between you and Shawcross. Now, during the course of this friendship, in the beginning stages, was it simply just business as usual for Shawcross, or was he trying to manipulate you or use you in any way?
No, I never felt manipulated. It was part business and part friendly. Once he figured out what type of person I was, and I did explain that to him in the letter that, I really am in a kind of similar position psychologically, then he loosened up and he got very friendly after that. I mean, long after I stopped selling his artwork because eBay banned it, we were still getting along, and even that was before we got into the book. So there was a period there where we just there was a letter about every 2 weeks, and he didn't present himself as a celebrity. We just like a friend. We just got into some strange topics in regard to cannibalism and murder and all that fun stuff. I guess I mean. I don't see eye to eye with him on everything. I don't necessarily agree on what he did, but I certainly understand it. As far as identifying with serial killers, it would be more along the lines of a Dahmer, where they say killing for company, that type of thing. Arthur Shawcross himself, I consider it more of a destroyer. He's more like a kind of a human terminator, as I put it. For some reason, we did hit it off. It was beyond, way beyond the business. That was actually a small portion of it, of our relationship. Just like two friends talking and, over a beer or something like that.
Well, John, I think me and the Colonel have different conversations than you and Arthur had.
John, did this ever go beyond just letters? Did you ever go meet him in person?
He, that was kind of a contentious deal there because toward the end of our relationship, because I was supposed to go and meet him up in New York, and I had just come back from Arizona investing in a low budget movie and kind of exhausted my funds, so I was going to take a little while before I could get up there. So when I wrote him telling him I was going to visit, he thought that was going to be right away. So he said, "Well, I thought you said you were going to visit," and he was angry about that. I said, "Well, just give me another month or so to collect my funds." But you know, things started falling apart after that. That was again towards the end of our relationship. But he was upset that I didn't get to visit him. He thought I was going to come up to see him a lot sooner.
All right. So Shawcross and Son of Sam were actually in the same prison together.
Yeah, and I heard that Arthur Shawcross actually despised David Berkowitz, the Son of Sam. Did he ever mention that to you, John?
Oh, I resented him, yeah. The money that Berkowitz makes and money that he did not make, Shawcross himself. Oh, yeah. It was resentment that Berkowitz was a little more popular and got more funding than him. Yeah, so he did talk about him.
Over the years, there have been several books written about Arthur Shawcross and many newspaper or magazine articles. Was Shawcross keeping tabs on what was written about him? Was he reading his own material?
Yeah, absolutely. He absolutely did. He did a lot of reading in general, but he definitely kept up on his own press and whatever books were written about him. Yes.
Did Shawcross ever mention the book The Misbegotten Son by Jack Olson?
Yeah. I'm remembering now, actually. Yes, he had mentioned Jack Olson several times. Actually, he sent me an envelope like with Jack Olson's return address on it that Shawcross had signed. You know, so, I have an envelope here with Jack Olson's return address on it, believe it or not. Not that I'm thinking of it.
John, did Arthur ever ask you about females in your life? Maybe your mother, sister, or girlfriend or somebody?
Yeah, once in a while he would ask what was going on in my life as far as females. But you know, for the most part, I was isolated. You know, he asked about my cousin Michelle, for instance, and who was actually, for a period there, pregnant at the time, and he would joke about that, say, for instance. He never mentioned my mother or sister or anything, but yeah, definitely, like, the focus was on my pregnant cousin Michelle at the time, yeah.
Did he ever ask you to send him things or pictures of these women?
Just picture of her pregnancy, basically, which he did get a copy of a picture of. A photo of my cousin Michelle showing her belly there at the time. But that was more for comedy's sake, really.
Did he ever ask you to send him anything weird or anything that would be considered contraband?
He never requested anything. I sent him stuff that they confiscated, but yeah, he never directly requested anything because he knew it would be confiscated. Yeah.
All right, so we're not going to ask you about that, but
John, after you told Shawcross about some of your darker fantasies,
mm-hmm.
do you feel like he ever tried to manipulate you or send you encrypted messages to kind of point you in the direction or push you over the edge and get you to do some of the horrible things that he has done?
Yeah, and I guess a read between the lines kind of way. He'd say things like, be good or be good at it, you know, and we both knew what we were talking about there in that regard, and about pressure points, how to choke a person properly, you know, along those lines. So, yeah, there you go. So the answer is yes. He was kind of teaching me, I guess, how to kill or hurt people. Yeah.
But do you think he was trying to push you in that direction?
He didn't seem to directly want that, but he didn't seem to be against it either. You know, he knew where I was in my life, so he didn't discourage my line of thinking, you know, at all. You know, so it almost seemed like he was encouraging it, and whether he meant to or not, he was. You know, talking about how to pick up hitchhikers and, again, choke them, you know, beheadings, and, you know, that's all that lovely stuff. Yeah. And of course, cannibalism is often a topic of discussion between he and I. He instructing me on how to properly cook a human being, for instance. Again, I guess the simple answer is yes, in his own way, he wasn't discouraging me at all.
So I know that you guys spoke about cannibalism a lot because that is one of your dark fantasies.
A lot of times when he ate pieces of people. It was raw. But other times he had mentioned, say, roasting the say calf muscles and over an open flame and indulging in that. And basically it was focused on like the calf muscles and the, I guess, the buttocks of women in particular. Yes, so he would he talked about that quite a bit with me, actually. He went back and forth on that. And I don't necessarily agree, again, with his type of cannibalism, because his was more destruction cannibalism. My interest would be, again, something like absorbing the person, somebody you have affection for, assimilation, you know, kind of a quick and dirty way to upload a person's soul into your own soul. His was more, I would say, barbaric. Mine would be more ritual, I suppose. I mean, my interest, anyway.
How long did your correspondence go on with Arthur Shawcross?
It was very, a little over 5 years. And it was about a letter every 2 weeks, like I said.
Now, there's an article out there that states that you had said at one point in your life, Arthur Shawcross was more of a father figure or maybe even a better father figure to you than your own father or males in your life.
Yes, well, that's also true. The male figures in my life have been brutal and ignorant, you know, even worse than Shawcross's opinion, just, in a sense, they abused me growing up and in one way or another. And basically, it was just physical or verbal abuse. But my own father, he never mentally grew up, but he's vicious. He's still basically 9 years old mentally, but he's extremely vicious and aggressive. And then my surrogate father, my Uncle Jerry, he was a brutal man. You know, he was vicious and violent. And so I had no one to really turn to. And, figures like friends, they're all psychopaths and criminals. And it was so bad. I ended up seeing Shawcross, I guess, as the lesser of evils, as they say. You know, and I got along with him a hell of a lot better than the other male figures in my life. You know, so that's how that goes.
Well, and John, and just to be clear, we're not saying that Shawcross is a better person or a better man than these two individuals. We're just simply saying that your correspondence with him, he treated you with more respect, maybe kindness and friendship than these others have shown you.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. That's it. That's how bad, that's what I'm saying. That's how bad the other men were. But I had to turn to one of the worst serial killer cannibals this world's ever known. So there you go. It's my life.
What did you know about Shawcross before he reached out to you?
Well, again, throughout my life, I've been seeking somebody I could, kind of speak with or identify with, you know. So I've been studying, say, serial killers and occults since I was nine or 10 years old. I started with a Zodiac killer, again, because I was feeling differently than everybody else. I knew it was different, and I was just searching for some answers, you know. So that's the main reason I got into it. So I had read, by that time, 2000, I had read a couple of books about him, Jack Olson's book and Bill Norris' material. And so I did know about him. I had read about him, and at the very least, if not seen, at least a documentary about him.
And he discovered you because you were selling things on eBay. Was Shawcross interested in any of your collections?
Well, let's see. He was fascinated with the Shrunken Head collection. I collected Shrunken Head replica Shrunken Head. Well, one was made out of a real human skull, apparently. But, collecting those, and he was very interested. I don't think he'd be collecting them himself. He didn't seem like much of a collector type, but he was very interested in it and made some money about it. But, yeah, I used to collect the Shrunken Heads and mummified heads, mummified heads. So, I've since sold them, but I'd like to start recollecting at some point. Yeah, I did get to hold a real one. The man I sold them to, he had a real and authentic one. I got to hold as a little museum, as a tattoo parlor that I visited. And, so that was an interesting experience. Very interesting day. That was a day for a lot of firsts for me. Get into that another time, but yeah.
What was your takeaway from this pen pal relationship with this serial killer?
Yeah, well, it's a very twisted thing to say, but I almost felt wanted and accepted That was the main thing, that there was someone out there who would accept me. I guess that's the bottom line. I mean, that sums it up.
Other than people's interest in true crime, what are the other reasons to go out and pick up your book?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's not meant to be gratuitous, and it's not one-dimensional. It's not just I'm just stuck and stagnant at this phase where I'm thinking this way. This is about a recovery from it, a recovery from, I say, purging my boogeyman from this type of thinking, and as well as the addictions to alcohol and drugs. I mean, that's what it's about. It's about coming out on the other side of this at the end of it. And if the thing is, if somebody else is having either these types of thoughts or addictions, the main thing is you have to find someone you trust you could talk to. You got to talk about it. You have to find a therapeutic way to exercise these demons without hurting anybody. That's the main thing. That's what I got to get across. I'm not just sitting here drooling and grinning maniacally. I really, this is about my getting better. You know, that's the point. And I've improved almost a 180 degree turn. Almost, maybe it's 178 or so, but I'm getting there. But yeah, this is really, I've recovered for the most part from that frequency of thought, as I say. But yeah, that's the thing. It's really not meant to be, something where I'm reveling in the evil. It's not that at all. You know, because this was therapeutic to write the book. This is a therapy for me. Again, you know, to work out these demons in as diplomatic and healthy a way as I could. You know, that was the main thing. That's, you know, I had to get it out of my system.
Well, of course, Captain, our recommended reading this week is The Shawcross Letters, My Journey into the Mind of Evil by John Paul Fay and Brian Whitney. You can pick that up at Amazon or wherever books are sold. I want to thank Brian and John for chatting with us.
And all of our recommended readings are on our website, so check out truecrimegarage.com. Click on the recommended page. And if you're not listening on the Stitcher app, make sure you download it. We'll be announcing something very soon about partnering with them on a cool project.
All right. Well, thank you, Captain. Very exciting stuff. And thank you to everybody out there. Until next time, be good, be kind, and don't litter.